Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Film Alchemy's The Moving Image Podcast, where we discuss all things classic, films, music, and social events. I'm your host and navigator, the scribe, Bob Batista. Today's show is about one of the most iconic actors from classic Hollywood, Frederick Nielsen Meyer Weizenfrump, better known as Paul Muni. And my guest is one who knows a great deal about him, Elsie. Welcome, Elsie, to The Moving Image.
Hi, Bob. I'm really glad to be here.
Oh, wow. I've been looking forward to this, and it's so great and so glad that it's here. So, Elsie, it's a pleasure having you on, and our topic is a great one. So my first question is, who was Paul Muni?
Paul Muni was described and hailed as the greatest actor in the world by Warner Brothers. That's how they billed him back in the 1930s. He was nominated for an Academy Award 6 times. He played the starring role in any number of Warner Brothers prestige dramas at the time. So he was, I'd say, kind of the Meryl Streep of the 1930s to relate him to modern times.
So when did you become a huge Paul Muni admirer, and how did this happen?
Well, I actually kind of backed into it, Bob. I mean, I love classic movies, but I had always more been watching the ones from the 50s, 60s, 70s. I'm a writer and researcher, and I was doing some research for myself about family history and specifically about the Holocaust. I got interested in what did Americans know about the Holocaust when it was going on? And
right.
I ran across, which is, you know, beyond the scope of this podcast. But what I ran across was a what they called a pageant. It was like a live show that was produced by Ben Hecht, the screenwriter. He was the one who wrote Scarface. He wrote The Front Page, a very famous early Hollywood screenwriter. And a number of famous actors were involved in this production. I saw a clip of Paul Muni reading a warning to the world, basically. It's on the Holocaust Museum's website. You can Google it. We Will Never Die is the name of the pageant. And I'm like, who is this man who speaks with such authority? Oh, it's Paul Muni? I think I saw Chain Gang 30 years ago. Who was this man? So I actually got interested in his activism and then backed into it about his movies.
Well, let's talk about Paul's early life as a youth. What is his background?
Well, it's actually really interesting and quite unique. As you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, he was born Meshulam Weizenfreund. He was born in the Ukraine the modern day Ukraine was then what was called the Jewish Pale of Settlement. It was this part of Eastern Europe, Ukraine, Poland, Romania, where basically was the area where Jews were allowed to live. And Muni was born in a trunk, so to speak. His family were street performers. They were wandering Jews. This was in the 1890s that he was born. And he and his parents and his brothers, Muni was the youngest, would wander from town to town and perform on the street corners. They actually, his earliest memory was of playing the tambourine and passing it for coins when his parents performed. And by the way, the name Muni actually is equivalent to Mickey, say, in English. So he was called Muni Weisenfreund. And it's kind of funny to me that someone who became such a dignified prestige actor, actually his name is Mickey, and that's what he went by his entire life.
So I'm thinking
Muni's
that.
Muni's dad got tired of being poor, and got tired of the oppression that they faced, and eventually the family immigrated first to London and then made its way to the United States.
So I'm thinking that Paul didn't have too much quote-unquote formal schooling. I'm thinking that he just went right into basically performing. Is that correct?
That's correct. Muni's dad, like a lot of immigrants, thought he was going to set the world on fire when he got to New York City. He was going to become a great actor in the Yiddish theater. The family spoke no English when they got here. But like millions of Jews that were coming to the United States, they spoke Yiddish, and there was this thriving theater scene in New York that actually was starting to become very important. Well, Muni's dad couldn't break into it. And they ended up moving out to Chicago, where the Weisenfreunds opened a theater for Jewish immigrants there. Muni had a couple years of elementary school. In fact, he went 1 year on the Lower East Side to the same elementary school as Edward G. Robinson went to. He was also an immigrant child. When Muni was 12, he made a stage debut in his parents' theater, and he never went to school again. He was very verbal and was self-educated, loved to read, became, as anyone who's ever heard him speak, the master of speaking English, you know, beautiful English, but it was self-education.
So I know that he was on Broadway and performed in a few plays and was really successful. So let's talk about the leap that he made from Broadway to Hollywood in films. How did that come about?
Well, what happened was he started out essentially in Yiddish vaudeville. He made his way up to what they called Yiddish art theater by the time he was in his 20s, and then made the leap to English-speaking roles and Broadway. Well, at that time, right, he was about 29 or 30, was when Hollywood, you know, made the leap from silent films to talkies. And that was very, very famous, that Hollywood went and raided Broadway for people who could talk. And he first signed with 20th Century Fox to did a couple of movies there, and they deemed him uncastable. They couldn't figure out what to do with him, and he was let go from Fox. about a year or so later, Howard Hawks and Howard Hughes were getting together to make the movie Scarface. And like, who are we going to get to play this role? Hawks had seen Muni on Broadway, and he's like, I know who can play this role.
So as you just said, Hawks and Hughes, Muni shoots to stardom playing the Capone-like gangster Tony Camonte in the original Scarface. Now, how did Paul feel about this role, and was this the only time he played a gangster?
Well, he had played gangsters in the theater.
Okay.
And, yeah, he had played gangster roles on stage. Story so telling people in time. And he found that immersing himself in the role of Tony Camonte was not something he wanted to continue to, that kind of part was not something he wanted to continue to do. He wanted to make movies that were, and take roles that were socially conscious, that were idealistic, that made people feel hopeful about being human or about the future. And he decided after Scarface that he wasn't going to play any more villainous roles. And indeed, he did not. It ended up eventually leading to parting of the ways late, you know, 10 years later in his film career. But he had this vision that he shared at that time with Warner Brothers of making these kind of socially conscious movies.
Well, speaking of socially conscious movies and Warner Brothers, another one of the roles he played the same year, 1932, was, I would say, my favorite Paul Muni film, that of James Allen in I Am a Prisoner from a Chain Gang. Now, what do you think about his performance in this film, Elsie?
Well, I agree with you. I think that this is, of all his acclaimed performances, this is one of the best performances anybody ever put on film, even here we are 90 years later. The emotional intelligence that he plays, James Allen, who for anybody who hasn't seen it, is an innocent man who is sentenced to this hopeless situation in a southern chain gang. His desperation, his hope, and then how these dreams are crushed. I mean, Muni conveys so much through his eyes, through his posture, through his voice, of the roller coaster of emotions, and of course then that unforgettable final scene.
Yeah, I recently saw this movie, and Muni goes through the, like you said, the gamut of emotions. You see just about every single form of emotion on Paul's face in this movie. Mm-hmm. And as you said, the climax at the end was just spectacular. And I totally agree. Like I said, this is my favorite. And he's made so many great movies, but this movie, I mean, he just knocked it out of the park. So Elsie, let me ask you, you say Paul was under contract to Fox Studios. Now, was he under contract to Warner's as well, or was he a freelancer at this time? I don't know the history of that.
So he was fired by Fox after two movies. He went back to Broadway. Scarface was an independent production with Howard Hughes. Then he was signed by Warner Brothers, where he was a contract player like everyone else was in those days. You know, in the studio right. system, you were essentially an employee. But Muni had a contract that no one else had. He had negotiated script approval, which they didn't do in those days, but they wanted to make these prestige movies. They wanted to show that the art form of film was something worthwhile. And they gave him script approval, and he used it. I mean, he would turn down movies. He would insist on changes to the script. He was much more like, you know, say, like Marlon Brando in later years than what was available to most actors back in the studio system. And that was how bad Warner Brothers wanted to keep him.
So, Elsie, what are some of the other films of Paul's that you would call essential Muni?
Well, there's two. He was known for playing, he became very well known for playing historical roles, what we now call the biopics.
Right.
So they were actually really inventing that art form at that time. And this was something that, I think it's hard for people now to get their head around, but making what we call, Oscar bait. The Oscars were new. Serious movies were new. And these biographical pictures, they were new. The story of Louis Pasteur is one I really recommend. This is the movie that Muni won the Oscar for. As I said,
right.
he was nominated 6 times. And he plays French scientist Louis Pasteur. The themes are intellectual freedom. And Pasteur was the pioneer of vaccines and sanitation. So it's also very timely in today's world. Yeah. The other biopic that I recommend in particular is The Life of Emile Zola and how he got beat out by Spencer Tracy in Captain's Courageous in the Oscars for this. I don't know. He immerses himself in the role of Emile Zola, who is a French author who would have been well known to people in 1937. I think we forget sometimes how much time has really gone by. So, you know, almost 90 years ago. But this author had been involved in trying to exonerate Alfred Dreyfus, the French officer in the Dreyfus Affair, who was accused of treason merely because he was Jewish. So this movie that Warner Brothers kind of obliquely address issues of anti-Semitism, but also of, you know, loyalty, of, again, of intellectual freedom, of European politics and the rise of Hitler in an oblique way it's very effective the way that they do it, though I do recommend reading reading Wikipedia about the Dreyfus Affair before you watch it. This is something
right.
I don't think most of us know about anymore. And the other one that I think is a must-see, though it's controversial these days, if, 10 years ago, even if you'd asked people, what's Paul Muni's most famous movie or his best role? They would say The Good Earth. And I still think The Good Earth is very, very much worth people's time to watch. It's a wonderful movie and wonderful performance by Muni.
And it's sad that his performance in The Good Earth, based on the novel by Pearl S. Buck, an excellent film. It's sad that it's not going to be watched probably, you know, by the youngsters and the people coming up because of that political correctness. He definitely, both he and his co-star give such a great performance. But again, because of that political correctness, and I'm talking about Louise Rainier, but because
right.
of that political correctness, I think it's going to be lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, I think it's really too bad. And it's a, I think, you know, it's great that people are holding Hollywood to account for a history of racism, but I hate to see movies like The Good Earth that I think really you could watch as a set with The Grapes of Wrath and Gone with the Wind as movies that were really addressing, like, people who had been displaced from the land and people who had been displaced by economic and natural disaster. I mean, this is what people in the 30s were concerned about. And I hate to see it overshadowed by the issues that we're concerned about now. It's an injustice to the movie.
Now, Paul was
Okay, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, Paul was a prolific actor in the 30s, but it seemed like his career kind of slowed down when the 40s came. What would you say happened?
Well, I'll kind of give the small picture and the big picture, but the small picture is he had a falling out with Jack Warner.
Really? Okay.
So, yeah, so that, you know, that was not good. So what happened was he made a third biographical picture called Juarez, which is also
right.
a really good movie, yeah, about the history of Mexico. And it wasn't a financial success. So it was very expensive. They filmed it on location, and it wasn't a success. So Muni wanted next to make a movie about Beethoven. And in fact, this movie did get made like 50 years later with Gary Oldman. I mean, it's Immortal Beloved. It took that long for Hollywood to make this movie about Beethoven. Jack Warner is like, we are not making any more of these movies. And you are going to play the villain in High Sierra, a gather gangster, and that is what you are doing. And we're not going to make these movies anymore. You are going to play the gangster part, and that's it. And Muni is like, well, no, I'm not going to do that. And it got into this, well, you know, well, then you're fired. You know, you can't fire me. I quit, kind of a thing. And Humphrey Bogart ends up playing this role in High Sierra, and it's the turning point in his career.
Right.
And he becomes the big star at Warner Brothers. Kind of the big picture is that Jack Warner needed Muni to build up the studio's reputation in making these serious socially conscious dramas. By 1940, the world is at war. Warner's not dumb. He sees that the motion picture business is changing. He's going to want to start the writing's on the wall. Needs new stars, make movies about the war. You know, I don't need Paul Muni being pain in my butt and paying him $50,000 for these kinds of movies we're not going to make anymore. So that's kind of the larger picture, where his role in Hollywood kind of went away.
You know, Elsie, I never read of Paul being blacklisted. Did that actually happen to him?
Well, you know, Bob, that's a topic that I'm really working on researching, because his biographer wrote a book called Actor. Jerome Lawrence really skirts the issue of him being blacklisted. But if you look at the actors who are named in these hearings and these FBI reports, his name is on those lists, you know, with Edward G. Robinson, with Frederick March, with Henry Fonda, you know, some of the ones who spent several years not being able to get any work. And it's sort of a nebulous topic. I mean, he was definitely involved in the same kind of controversial, you know, causes that later led them to be accused of being Reds. And in fact, you know, he did not make a movie except one in Italy from 1946 to 1959. He was very successful on stage and played on the radio and television. But to me, I think it's a topic that's really worth more research. I feel like it smacks of being blacklisted. And maybe Jerome Lawrence was just like kind of being nice. I'm not sure yet. I'll just be honest. I'm not sure yet exactly what went down.
In 1955, he resurfaces on Broadway in the play Inherit the Wind and wins the Tony Award. That must have been very rewarding to him.
It was. He went back to Broadway, you know, after parting ways with Warner Brothers and made several independent movies during the war as well. But he really went back to his roots and, you know, was a Broadway actor primarily and would do also when television got started, you know, Playhouse 90 and some of these productions had a lot of the classic stars from the 30s, and they were getting older, and I really wish these were available. But he was really looking for, you know, a signature play, and Inherit the Wind came along by two young playwrights, and it's about the Scopes trial, and he takes on originating the Clarence Darrow role in Inherit the Wind, and it's just an instant classic and a huge success. He plays opposite Ed Begley in the William Jennings Bryan role, and Tony Randall played the role that Gene Kelly plays in the movie. So, I mean, wouldn't you like a time machine to go back and see that?
Yeah. It said that.
Yeah,
it said that Muni is a Jewish-American icon, due in part to his activism. Talk a little bit about this part of his life.
Muni, along with, okay, a couple of things. Up until the 30s, Hollywood actors who were Jewish of course they had to change their names, and Muni was no exception. The studio forced them to change their names. Muni, along with Edward G. Robinson and John Garfield slightly later, were the first to be very openly, outspokenly Jewish and active in anti-fascist, anti-Hitler causes, and helping to form things like the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League, which later was part of what led to all three actors getting caught up to one degree or another in the blacklist. But he was, as I mentioned earlier, he was involved in raising people's awareness about the atrocities in Europe in the We Will Never Die production. that was the first to publicly state that, you know, millions of people were being killed. He was on the radio frequently on behalf of Jewish causes, and he was an ardent and very outspoken Zionist. He was in a play that was also written by Ben Hecht called A Flag Is Born, where he played, I mean, this makes me kind of want to cry. He played Tevye, is the same character who's the lead in Fiddler on the Roof. In this play, A Flag Is Born, Tevye and his wife are survivors of Treblinka.
Mm.
And they are trying to make their way after the war to the land of Israel with another young man survivor who they meet, who was played by Marlon Brando. It was Marlon Brando's stage debut in this play.
Wow.
A Flag Is, yeah, I know, right? And so he was an icon in that era where the showing a way that an immigrant or Jewish American could be successful, could be American while still retaining their Jewish identity. And this made him someone who was very special to the Jewish community, and he never turned down a chance to do radio production or go speak or raise money on behalf of the Jewish community. It was very important to him.
A few years ago, I saw what was said to be his last film, his last acting role, a movie called The Last Angry Man. I understand he was also nominated for an Oscar for this role as well.
Yes, he was. I just got to see that movie for the first time a couple weeks ago. It might still be on the Criterion Channel. And it's a delightful performance.
Yeah.
Buny was, an older man by then, and he plays Dr. Sam Abelman, who's a ghetto doctor. It's in Brooklyn. The neighborhood is changing from Jewish to African American. And it's, the movie is, wouldn't you say, kind of low budget? But the performance is a wonderful swan song for Buny, and I think he really appreciated the chance to play a lead role that was a Jewish character, because in the 30s, they weren't making any movies like that. You know, he didn't
right.
play. He played like every ethnicity under the sun except Jewish in the movies. They rather
right.
simply weren't those kind of roles. Yeah. Yeah, he was French, he was Norwegian, he was Italian, he was anything.
Chinese.
Yeah,
so,
if it's mm-hmm. yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it's just an amazing career. But one of the reasons why I liked The Last Angry Man as well is because I grew up in Brooklyn, not too far from the neighborhood that it was basically based on. So, yeah, that's another reason why I enjoyed Buny and that movie. So, but in closing, Elsie, how will Paul Buny be remembered? And where would you say his place is among the classic Hollywood greats?
Well, I hope that he will be remembered. Paul Buny blazed the trail for serious acting in the movies. You know, he's not a John Wayne. He's not a Humphrey Bogart. He blazed the trail for people like Al Pacino, for people like Daniel
De Niro.
Davis,
mm-hmm.
De Niro, Gary Oldman, you know, these people who, Anthony Hopkins, people who bring the best qualities of the American or British theater to the movies. He brought not a kind of a selflessness, I think, of not wanting to be a movie star, but an actor. And there's still a place for that in the movies. And I hope that he'll be remembered as a pioneer and a trailblazer and someone who it's worth seeking out this, you know, this founding father of serious acting on the American screen. That's my feeling.
Well, he surely is one of my favorites, I'll tell you that much. So Elsie, give out your Twitter handle and any other social media contacts you have.
My Twitter handle is easy to remember if you've been listening to this podcast. It's at Mr. Paul Muni 1. So if you just search for Paul Muni, it's the first thing that comes up. It's the only thing that comes up. But I hope that people listening will get interested, because it's been very rewarding for me, Bob.
Yes, I can see that, and I see it every day in communicating and watching your tweets and all of that. And that's one of the reasons why I said, you know what, I have to have you on the show. And what a show it was. So there's the music.
Well,
thank
you.
And our show is about to end. You're welcome. You can contact the show at our email at filmalchemynj@gmail.com and leave any comments or suggestions. In my opinion, Paul Muni was one of the most gifted and talented actors in Hollywood or anywhere else. Thank you so much, Elsie, for enlightening us on this wonderful human being and also being my guest on The Moving Image.
Thanks again. It was wonderful.
It was so good and so rewarding and so knowledgeable. Have a great evening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I live by a credo, and that is, we must live telling stories. Until next time, this is Bob Batista, signing off.